Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it's always a pleasure to welcome the Saker back for quarterly reports on the Saleri report. Since we've talked to him last, a great many events have unfolded, including the extraordinary U-turns by the Trump administration. So I was really delighted that he's back from his travels and he could join us today. Saker, welcome back to the United States and welcome to the Saleri report.
Thank you. As always, it's a privilege and a real pleasure for me to be talking to you. And indeed, we have left some pretty dramatic events. My God, what a quarter year that has been.
Well, it was really funny. Somebody sent me today a question saying, what do you think the chances are of a hot war? And I gave percentages on all the different situations that were relatively small. And then I said, chances of members of Congress of the Washington establishment ordering assassinations and killing on each other, 90%.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So that by far and away got the highest percentage. So yeah. Let's dive in with Syria. It's hard to separate Syria and ISIS, but we start with the president doing a remarkable U-turn and making a decision to bomb Syria after, and then subsequently bomb Afghanistan after an alleged sarin gas attack. So let's start with the alleged sarin gas attack. What happened?
Well, whatever happened, it was certainly not sarin, that's for sure. If you look at the footage, it's pretty clear that the people involved, I mean, in both locations, by the way, and the location where the attack happened, and then at the airbase which was bombed, there were people there. None of them were wearing the kind of protective gear that would be required if you were in direct contact with sarin gas. So sarin gas it was not. What was it? I think there's two options, one which I prefer over the other. I think my personal theory, it's a deliberate false flag on the part of the United States because there was real risk of peace breaking out in Syria. And the problem was is that peace breaking out in Syria would have happened without the indispensable nation. So in a perverse way, by bombing that place and by wrecking that peace process, the United States has reinstated itself as a partner that cannot be bypassed in a peace process in the region. So there's almost a logic to that. Was the second possible event? I doubt it. Well, first of all, a coincidence. The Syrians bombed a place which just happened to have stores of probable chlorine or other chemical substances which might be used to manufacture chemical weapons. As we know, the good terrorists use chemical weapons. There have been instances proven in Syria, and there are instances going on a regular basis in Iraq. So maybe the Syrians just got bad luck and hit a production facility of the good terrorists, or maybe they were cued in by Americans manipulating intelligence well and giving them something which would bring in an airstrike, which could then be blamed on Assad. Whatever, if it is a coincidence, it's one heck of a coincidence.
So I don't know if you saw, Robert Perry had a report saying that a Saudi-Israeli operation used a drone to deliver something.
Yeah, I saw that. My approach is always, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Maybe, but I've seen no evidence of that. So I can only, I'd rather base myself on facts which are known. And I would say the speed with which the strike happened on the U.S. side is, I think, also very telling. I mean, I think Trump really wanted badly to show that America is great again in an imperial sense, unfortunately. And that's what we have. And I can't think of a worse way of wrecking the entire U.S. foreign policy in Syria, to be honest, and the Middle East generally. I mean, it was one of the most incompetent actions I can think of, and a total betrayal of everything he promised.
Well, here's what's interesting. They dropped 59 Tomahawk, or they shot 59 Tomahawk missiles. Half didn't go through. He gave Russia and Syria an hour warning before he did it, and it didn't destroy the air, the runways at the air base. And you almost wonder whether it was just kind of a reality TV show.
It was partially that, but see, he really had no other option. Had he not warned the Russians The consequence would have been much worse for everybody. And I think I don't buy this issue that the Tomahawk's in such bad reliability that, you know, over half don't make it. I think the Russians used electronic warfare equipment
right.
to bring down either as many as they could, or maybe even let some through to not, because if they had stopped most of them or all of them, that would have required a restrike. But my
right.
guess is they tried to stop the best they could, and the best they could was the 36 that they did, they managed to make them disappear. There is also a theoretical other option, which would be that the United States deliberately shot 59 of them and then made a number of them just plunge into the Mediterranean because it was a show. Clearly, this was not a military operation in a military sense. The runways were not hit. There was no revisit, restrike, which normally happens always when you try to destroy an objective. I think the Americans knew that there were no chemical weapons locally. So what was the point of destroying? You know, it wasn't really a military operation. It was a statement. I think an extremely inept one, but I do agree with you. It was a show and a statement, yes.
Well, it was a statement that cost $94 million in terms of the Tomahawk missiles.
Yeah, and an unknown number of lives, but much worse than that. I think it's the last nail in the coffin of any hopes of the U.S. and Russia working together. It's just not going to happen.
Right.
So that's the real terrible consequence.
Well, I'm still trying to figure out why. Now, right before it happened, we had all sorts of pipeline politics in Europe. And I know you say you don't follow the economics, but we had Israel proposing a pipeline from essentially Israel and the Golan Heights.
Yeah.
And if you look at the players involved, a lot of the players involved are very much connected to the players right now around the president. You know, it's kind of remarkable. And you have the Nord Stream pipeline also, more approvals and things going on with the EU. So you have the Russians proposing to send gas in through the Nord Stream pipeline, and then you have the Israelis proposing to send gas in and developing some of that oil and gas, I believe, requires more control over the Golan Heights. And part of the politics of ISIS is ISIS has, you have both Syria and ISIS impacting connecting gas fields. Does that make any sense?
Oh, absolutely. It makes a great deal of sense. And I've recently written an article where I said that actually having ISIS in power in Damascus would actually be something that the Israelis want. For one thing, it gives them a wonderful pretext to establish a security zone. It could be the Golan Heights that they've annexed, or more of the Golan Heights, or even to try to push up to the Litani River, whatever. They have that wonderful pretext. Secondly, it gives them a pretext to bomb Hezbollah as much as they want again. They know that ISIS is a mortal enemy of Hezbollah, so it's wonderful they can hope for a civil war in Lebanon, and that again, they can only achieve if they destabilize Lebanon like they did with Syria. And finally, Assad is the only hope for unitary Syrian states, which they don't want. So there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that what you're saying about the pipeline fits perfectly in the rest of the picture of what the Israelis want in Syria.
Well, the Financial Times mentioned a whole bunch of firms in connection with the Israeli pipeline financing, which is going to be about $6 billion. So this is a very big deal. And there are rumors as to who are equity investors in the, because you have the equity and then you have the debt, presumably, that Goldman would do. But to me, it's very interesting because you had Condoleezza Rice go to the White House and meet with the president on the Friday before the week in which the false flag and the bombing occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And so Rice goes to the White House, meets with the president on Friday, and the next week we see Bannon out, Dina Powell, a Goldman Sachs partner, in, and onto the National Security Committee. She was already on the National Security Council.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of this unfold, including the bombing. So You almost look like you're watching oil investment politics.
Yes, or generally, I would say Israeli politics. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind who is behind the move to get rid of Flynn and Bannon. I mean, it's the Israel lobby, generally speaking.
So, well, here's my question. How much of this has to do with trying to make it possible for Israel to basically finally assert complete control of the Golan Heights?
Partially, yeah. I think it's definitely partially part of that. But I think it's much more than just the Golan Heights. I mean, I think the Israeli plan is now to turn. They're going to hit Lebanon next. If they get their way in Syria, I can guarantee you that Lebanon is going to fall next. I mean, I can absolutely guarantee you that. You take it to the bank, because there already have been problems with the Daesh or ISIS types in Lebanon. And they won't stop. I mean, if they take complete control of Syria, first of all, it will be a complete elimination of Christians in Syria. And secondly, the next objective will be Lebanon. So, and since that is the cornerstone of Arab resistance against Israel through Hezbollah, that weakens. I mean, think about it. They would take down both Syria and Lebanon, who are to various degrees, allies of Iran, which that explains why the Saudis also want that. I mean, it's actually it's a perfect storm for the resistance to both Israel and the KSA. So I think it's a
Well, if
bigger
you
thing. I
could.
think the Golan Heights is definitely part of that, but I don't think it's the highest price. The highest price is a much bigger chunk of the region.
So, well, I would take it even higher than that because if you look at Wesley Clark's testimony that right after 9/11 he was presented with, we're going to destroy these seven countries in 5 years, Syria and Lebanon being on the list. And so, between Iraq and Libya, they got two after, but it took forever. But it certainly looks to me like the seven countries in 5 year plan has just gotten revved up again.
Yeah, but a very different way, because you have to really fully consider the consequences of the defeat of Israel by Hezbollah in 2006. That basically proved to the Israelis that they cannot do that using their own armed forces. So that's the key thing. Now they cannot use their own people. It's way too bloody, way too scary. They're too, they're not nearly as good as people. They have good PR, but their military is not nearly as good as that. And they know that they can't win against Hezbollah. But if you turn around now, a powerful, united, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, Daesh, ISIS, coalition, you unleash that on Hezbollah, even if they don't win, Hezbollah will have their hands full just trying to survive in Lebanon and protecting their own community at that point. So that I think is the key change of tactics. In the
Well,
past, the Israelis used the IDF. Now they're using, the Wahhabi crazies.
this gets us back to who created ISIS and, who controls their leash. So tell us a little bit about where ISIS came from. Who are they? Because it to me it looks like the US unleashed ISIS and now can't control them.
Well, those labels, ISIS, Al-Nusra, and all the other ones, I on the blog, I usually speak of them as Daesh, but we can say ISIS. It's the same, exact same thing as Al-Qaeda. They really were, what happened was that the United States, under Carter, when the Soviets were provoked into invading Afghanistan, they federated pretty small, pretty crazy out there groups together, brought them to Afghanistan. It was financed by the Saudis. The Americans organized them and made them into a more or less homogeneous fighting force in Afghanistan, which fought there for a while. After that, the very same people were unleashed in Chechnya and in Bosnia. Of course, then we have all the springs in Arab countries. It's all the same thing. It's a joint creation of the United States, Israel, and Saudi Arabia. They are the ones who created it. That's why they were the tool for the false flag of 9/11. I mean, because that is a tool that they control fairly well. Now, since a lot of ISIS actual people involved the fighting on the ground are poorly educated and not very knowledgeable people. Some of them just don't obey very well, so they have regular headaches with them. A good part of that in Iraq, for instance, are former officers of the Iraqi armies who see here a possibility of taking revenge against the United States and, also very important, of fighting against the Shia regime in Baghdad. So all of these things, every single American move in the Middle East contributed to create, and same thing in Pakistan, every move contributed to make that, what I call, maybe not very academically, the Wahhabi crazies, made them stronger and more numerous. And now this thing is just an epidemic. I mean, they can threaten, they control a lot of territory. They're actually very sophisticated. And when I call them crazies, I mean their ideology. But if you look at the kind of infantry they represent and their abilities to fight, they're actually very good. So nobody should dismiss them because they do crazy things. Crazy doesn't mean stupid. And they're definitely not stupid. They're very highly skilled and by now extremely experienced fighters. So it's a plague now. It's a threat for all of mankind, and the U.S. is still stoking it. I can't believe it.
Well, the Trump during his campaign made it a clear priority that he wanted to see ISIS destroyed, and he continues to make those noises.
Yeah, but look, there's certain facts which are simple and absolutely undeniable. The United States will not single-handedly send God knows how many thousands, hundreds of thousands of soldiers to destroy ISIS. The only people who are willing to put boots on the ground, it's not hard to find, it's the Syrian military and the Iranians. The Russians are willing to commit a certain degree, limited amount of people on the ground, and they'll support from the air and the sea. So if you're serious about destroying ISIS, you absolutely have to get a deal with Iran and Syria.
Is that one of the reasons that Obama made a deal with Iran?
Possibly, but I could say it could be part of the consideration, but that would imply that the people around Obama accepted the fact not only that Iran is absolutely needed to defeat ISIS, but secondly, I would even put it further. I say there is nothing happening in the Middle East that can happen against the will of Iran. Iranians are extremely powerful locally. That is why Israel hates them that much. I mean, if you look at all this canard about Iran having a nuclear weapon program, it's not about that. It's about Iran becoming the regional superpower. That's the real problem, not nuclear weapons. If Iran had nuclear weapons, it couldn't use them against Israelis anyways. So the real thing is that Iran becomes an indispensable entity for the entire Middle East. And by his strike, what Trump did, he alienated Iran, he alienated Hezbollah, and he alienated Russia. Who's he going to fight ISIS with? Israel and Saudi Arabia? Please. It's never happening.
So do the Americans have a plan to fight ISIS?
Look, if they had it, I'm not a mind reader. I can't tell you what they were thinking. But if the plan was to fight ISIS, that strike put an end to that plan. I mean, it's nothing complicated. It's basically you need boots on the ground. You will not defeat ISIS from the air. That has never been done. That kind of force that ISIS represents is not defeatable from the air. If anybody tells you otherwise, that's just not true. Agreed. There might have been people around Trump, like Flynn or Bannon, who really wanted to get serious with ISIS, and that's why they understood we need to talk to the Russians. They didn't understand that you need to talk to the Iranians also, which I deplore, because they should have been forthcoming about that. And I think Iran is at least as important as Russia locally. But if that was the plan and was gone with Bannon and Flynn gone, and the rest of them, I don't know who they are. I mean, I'm not going to name names because I don't know them. But what is clear is that missile strike made this entire plan, it terminated it. This is just not going to happen. I don't know what will happen, but this will not.
Right. So I have to tell you, watching the events over the last month, it absolutely looks to me like there's a third party trying to get the United States and Russia to go to war with each other. But it doesn't look to me like it's Russia or the United States doing it. It's a third party playing them. So, if you look at the bombing in St. Petersburg, you know, who did that? I would be surprised if it was the U.S.
I really don't think It is the U.S. behind it. I mean, again, I need evidence for extraordinary claims, extraordinary evidence.
Right.
If the U.S. wanted to war with Russia, well, the U.S. can start any time. I don't think they want to take that kind of risk. That's why they warned the Russians 2 hours before in Syria. The guy who did the bombing was arrested in Russia, the main act, the one who organized it all. If I do remember correctly, he's from Kyrgyzstan, but I'm not sure. But he comes from Central Asia and was one of those extremist Wahhabi cells that do operate in Russia, try to recruit people and organize that kind of events on a pretty regular basis, not as often as could be because the security services work very well, but some get through and succeed. I don't see a foreign hand in that. At least not directly. I mean, the foreign hand is direct in the
right.
sense that, yes, all support for ISIS types is a threat to everybody, including Russia. But I don't see the, you know, say, the CIA trying to start a war with Russia by being involved in a bombing in St. Petersburg.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
Not
well,
to
but when you get back to the concept of the, you know, crazies, I mean, the reality is we're watching the neocons basically reassert authority of the federal administration in the United States, and the neocons are crazy. Now, they're more educated crazy, but you're talking about the same kind of wacko crazy. I've worked with them. They're nuts.
Yeah, the crazies in the basement, as they were used to be called. Absolutely.
Right.
I agree with that.
I don't know if you
and
saw.
And I think what they're doing, rather than starting triggering a war with Russia, they're playing a game of what I call nuclear chicken, which is very, very stupid and totally reckless. But I think that's what they're hoping. They hope that, you know, by huffing and puffing and being tough, they are going to get the Russians to blink, which they're not. Actually, the kind of display that Trump has made in Syria and now in Korea is actually seen by Russians, if anything, as a sign of weakness. So it gets the exact opposite results. But I think that's what they're doing. I think they're crazy, I agree with you. And they're just clever enough to be really dangerous.
Well, I wonder though, where the craziness is coming from. I mean, I noted the Wall Street Journal in the last month has published two articles on the editorial page from Paul Wolfowitz. And you're thinking, you know, yes, maybe Rupert Murdoch is an investor in the Israeli pipeline, but Jesus, why would you let somebody who's that completely bonkers on your editorial page? So,
well, I just wrote an article about that. I called it Bringing Down the Elephant in the Room, because the elephant in the room are the crazies or the Israel lobby or whatever you want to call them. And I think they are truly intoxicated with their own ideology, their sense of impunity, their sense of being, you know, the best, the elect people. And they don't really care, for instance, if a million people die, as long as they come out fine. I think it's a combination of infinite arrogance, really satanic kind of evil, you know, cleverness but not intelligence, sort of short-term intelligence, which makes you clever but also makes you very self-defeating. So, yeah, I think that's a good question. How is it that
well,
they're
it's
that crazy?
It's very interesting because when I go back, you know, when I go back to, I really believe that ultimately all organized crime is local.
Mm-hmm.
But when I go back to I grew up in Philadelphia, and basically what you saw was you had power, you had competition and cooperation between three huge power bases. One was the Masons, one was the Vatican, and one was the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they cooperated and they competed. And, you know, in certain ways, it was the high wasps among the Freemasons who were in charge, you know, but other times it was the Vatican who was in charge. And then, you know, the Jews were a smaller group, but they were very, you know, they were very aggressive and effective in certain ways. But there was huge cooperation between the three of them. And the increasingly, as the federal budget grew, the intelligence agencies got more and more powerful. And then combined the telecommunications, and it looked to me like the, you know, the Jews and the Freemasons had outwitted the Vatican and the Jesuits because they got a hold of the digital systems. But if I had to say who was the most powerful at that time, it was the Vatican. And so you couldn't have the Israelis running around and being this nuts, or the, mm-hmm. you know, the 800 hound gorilla running around being this nuts, unless the Vatican. You know, there's one theory that bops around among certain historians that the Vatican is giving them a long enough leash so that they can end up 10 years from now with Israel not existing and they control Jerusalem. Which is not, you know, it sounds crazy, but it's really, if you know the Vatican, it's not as crazy as it sounds. So, why they're being allowed to run this nuts is what I'm still shaking my head, because it started with 9/11, you know, and
yes, agreed.
It looks to me as though the only logical explanation I can come up with is they're looking to create a digital currency, and they need everybody in the tent. That's behind the 7 countries in 5 years. That's everybody got to get inside to assert a digital currency before you lose control of your oil standard behind the dollar reserve currency. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is the City of London and the financial networks in G7 trying to make sure that they assert control before the Asian per capita incomes converge and they lose control.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you're trying to preserve a financial digital unipolar world is what it smells like, which brings us to North Korea, because North Korea, I mean, Russia has a central bank that's in the BIS. North Korea doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Can I just comment on your three actors?
Sure.
Before we switch to that? I thought about this issue along similar lines, identifying similar actors, but I'll tell you the way where I differ from you is that, first of all, I don't see the Vatican as having much power left at all. It's been beaten down and pretty much castrated.
Right.
By Jewish interest. The Masons have gone mainstream because really, what sense is there in being a Freemason today in a world which basically is the world they wanted to create? We live in a paramasonic society. Their ideas are absolutely mainstream. And you don't have to be a Mason to support the kind of values and philosophy that were underlying Freemasonry for its during the, you know, its existence. So I don't see the Masons as being that crucial either. Now, it leaves Jews, or I prefer to say organized Jewry, but even there I see a change in types because what you're describing, for instance, are business interests, which tend to be rational, whereas what I see at the top of organized Jewry is ideological people who are not rational at all, who are not calculating and trying to get an optimal solution for their interest. I see people who, well, as we said, have gone crazy, and all I can say
is they're not really. You're not really talking about Jews when you, because I read your article. You're talking about Zionists.
Yes, I call them Zionists because Zionism combines two forms of Jewish.
Right, it's hard to think of Dick Cheney as Jewish.
Exactly, absolutely, and you have people who are ethnic Jews who are fighting at the forefront against this group, including, you know, Finkelstein, Gilad Atzmon.
It's not, we ought to just stop, and I'm dying to get Norm Finkelstein on the Slayer Report. Is he not the most courageous man in the world?
He's remarkable. I have utmost
He's a remarkable
for him,
man.
But the most courageous, I think, is Gilad Atzmon.
Really?
He's the most daring, and he's really a philosopher. Besides being a fantastic jazz musician, this man is truly a philosopher. I mean, that's one you should get on your show. He's pure gold in my book. So what you have is go ahead.
You go.
I see more of a class consciousness in a Marxist sense of the world that got an elite. I spoke of an old Anglo-Guard versus the new neocons or the new Zionists. I think we have a perfect combination of people who are essentially profoundly materialistic, who don't have human values, and who I think act on a vision that they have. I mean, they're true believers at the top there. And
right.
That's scary. That's not good news. True believers can be good news, but in that case, I think it's very bad news. I think they're united by a common ideology and a common identity, and that is really scary.
Well, the thing that most concerns me about that group is they, there's a wonderful book by a Polish psychologist called Political Ponerology, and he talks about how 5% of the human race are just born without any kind of empathy gene.
Correct.
They're basically psychopaths, and they're great at finding each other and conspiring and collaborating for political benefit. And if you let them get control of the machinery, It's very dangerous because, in fact, the rest of the population can't fathom that they don't have human empathy.
Absolutely. So, I agree with that entirely.
Right.
There's something else, too. You know what? Minorities are usually organized against on a very simple, narrow project. Most of us, you know, the basket of deplorables, the majority, we have all sorts of interests, all sorts of views, etc. Minorities typically organize against a narrow agenda. And far from being more intelligent or more skilled, which that's a myth, they're simply far more driven.
Right.
You're never going to have, you know, a Portuguese banker caring about the ethnicity of the person he's going to make a deal with. He doesn't care. These guys do.
Right.
So it's not that they're smarter. They're just driven in a way that we normal people, the non-crazies, cannot even fathom most of the time.
Right.
That's
right.
What makes them such formidable actors, even though they're a minority in terms of numbers.
Right. That's true. That's true. For somebody who doesn't, who has never dealt with the neocons, Charlie Ferguson has a great DVD video on that he did on the occupation of Iraq,
mm-hmm.
And sort of the intentional destruction of civic and civil infrastructure, you know, and replacing everybody with U.S. contractors who had no idea what to do or how to do it, you know, but could do it at 20 times the price.
Mm-hmm.
And it's remarkable because it shows you how crazy they are. And you have all the sort of the Americans who were sensible and intelligent who were appalled at how
mm-hmm.
that went down. And
absolutely.
Describing how nuts it was. And you kind of see, they really think you bring order from creating complete chaos. You know, so there's, you know, you just destroy it and they think it's going to grow up again like green shoots. So,
plus, you know, it's a short-term buck, which I think is very central. And generally, all their tactics are totally short-term, and to hell with the consequences. And I think we're also dealing with a system, now that's, again, very bad news, the empire generally, that promotes the spineless, the unimaginative, and the crazies, and basically selects them and pushes away decent, honorable, well-educated people. I mean, my daughter now is in college. And the kind of horror stories she tells me about the prevailing ideology there, it's unreal. I mean, and I'm really concerned about that, because that's very much what happened in Russia before the revolution, where basically the entire polity promoted mediocrities and pushed away the good people that could have made a change. I see that happening in the United States nowadays, where just, you know, the best of Americans are nowhere near the centers of decision-making and power. The worst of
the
worst.
Right, that's what I see. Right. Well, one of the things I wanted to mention is coming into the false flag and the bomb, or the alleged gas attack or sarin gas attack and the bombing. We saw Trump's approval ratings, which were not high anyway, going down as low as 43 and 42, and then he starts the bombing and it turns up and heads up to 50.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's interesting. I've talked to Trump supporters, and what they say is that they were really being bothered by all the negative news and bad news on Trump and all the sort of fighting in the media. And I've said to them, and they feel better now that that's over. And what I've said to them is, when he cuts the cash flows off from the unproductive, they shriek. Now, if you want him to cut the cash flows off from the productive, then you have to be able, you know, to not pay attention to the shrieking. If you pay
mm-hmm.
attention to the shrinking, you know, because now the cash flows are rolling back into the unproductive, and so they're happy, you know, and they're saying how wonderful he is, and Brian Williams is saying, you know, we have beautiful weapons, and, you know, and everybody's happy. And if that's good news for you, then, you know, basically you're being controlled by your enemy. And they can't seem to compute that.
I don't even know if I have any reasons to believe these opinion polls.
I can't believe
that people would be happy. They voted for peace and they get war again and they're happy with that. I just can't believe it's true.
I don't think so.
My knee jerk reaction is something was happening. They either selected the people, like for instance, maybe they went to a university and took only students who study with my daughter. Maybe they would answer that. But the real Trump supporters, I have a hard time believing that they're happy with what's going on right now. I just can't.
What I've heard, because I know,
maybe I'm naive.
I know a tremendous amount of highly educated people who voted for Trump, And when he bombed Syria, their reaction was complete alienation.
Yes. I mean, look at the look at Information Clearinghouse, who's been very good at, you know, reprinting all the articles of everybody who said Trump is a better solution, who came out in absolute disgust and outrage.
Right. Right. So
my guess is really his popularity is even lower than it was. But, you know, I can't prove it.
I think it's very, very possible. I do think I've been surprised at how, I mean, there's no doubt the sort of neocons have tremendous power in terms of turning the shrieker meter on and off.
Yeah,
and I think
absolutely.
That's one of their greatest powers. And
yeah,
and
I call it the Zio media now.
You call it what?
The Zio media, the Zionist media, because basically all they do, they're not even trying to hide anymore. They just
see. I think we ought to call it the Daesh media.
Same thing. It's the same thing.
It's
basically a propaganda machine which will, you know, churn out whatever is needed by those who control it. There is no effort into informing or analyzing or anything. It's gone.
Well,
even the pretext
it's very
is
interesting.
Now, which I welcome.
Very interesting. I did Greg Hunter's show about 6 weeks ago. And Clapperidge has come out and said that they had no evidence of any, you know, connection or coordination between the Trump campaign and the Russians. And they had no evidence of any Russian interference in the campaign. So Greg said, well, now it's all going to stop. And I said, no, it's not going to stop. It's going to keep going. It doesn't matter that there's no evidence.
Look, I just got an email from a friend of mine today who told me that she sent me a Yahoo article I haven't even had time to read, that yes, the FBI feels that there's enough evidence to investigate Trump on the basis of his contacts with the Russians. Business Insider published that an hour and 49 minutes ago. The title is, "We just got a huge sign that the U.S. intelligence community believe the Trump dossier is legitimate." I mean, you know what?
Oh, you're kidding.
This is ridiculous. This is. I mean, if it weren't really sad and frightening, it would be really funny somewhere.
Well, here's the thing. I lived through this for many, many years because they did it to me. And it was really funny because I insisted on going to trial. And every time I insisted on going to trial, they'd try and settle. I'd get poisoned. So it really became a war, and a physical war, literally. And so we finally went to trial. And my attorneys were so overprepared. And then they came in the first day, and there was nothing. They had nothing. Because they'd always had nothing. And I turned to the attorney, and I said, I told you they had nothing. Oh, he turned to me, and he was white as a sheet. He said, they have absolutely nothing. I said, I told you that. He said, I just couldn't believe they had nothing. I said, there is nothing. There's nothing they could have. But,
listen,
but you know,
there were other cases in the past. We know the Republicans had contact with the Iranians during the hostage crisis. McCain had contact with Saakashvili during the wars. I mean, even it's always been a thing that if you're on top of U.S. policy, and I think it's normal, you do speak to other people, particularly other people that matter. So I'm sure that if they want to desperately prove that Flynn and other people, maybe even Bannon, had contacts with the Russians, I'm sure he did, as he should have. I hope that people who want to apply to the National Security Council have been exposed to the main actors on the world stage.
Well, but here's the other thing. It's funny because I'm on Twitter, and I've got one guy on my Twitter feed who rabidly hates the Russians. And so he came back and he said, you know, Trump has gotten financing from Russia. I said, of course, he's a New York State real estate developer. They all got financing from the Russians. Are you out of your mind? That's like saying I live in the South and, you know, I eat barbecue chicken. You know, so what?
I'm not even sure it's even true. Does he need money from anybody?
Sure. Oh, sure. You know, there have been different times when he's dealt either for his own reasons or in the you know, sort of during the bailout period, you get liquidity drying up. Now, here's why I say this. If you look at the Goldman Sachs team that runs Goldman now, or that he's got, you know, Gary Cohen, basically they engineered the strong dollar policy, if I'm right. My theory is they were right at the heart working with Rubin at Treasury, Blankfein and Cohen running the fixed income division. And that was part of reengineering a strong dollar, pushing the gold price down to make it work, and moving, bubbling the economy with a housing bubble, because they had government securities and mortgage securities and the precious metals all within the same division that they ran. And so it was sort of a three-leg stool. And part of that, during that period, particularly early on, you had the Treasury run the covert op to kind of rape Russia and get, you know, U.S. and Citi interests owning a lot of the oil companies and the equity. Mm-hmm. And during that period, the U.S. intelligence agencies, both Treasury and I assume CIA, were teamed up with the Russian mob. And they were laundering huge amounts of money, you know, in through New York, through the Bank of New York and these other financial institutions. You know, and I have all kinds of theories about where that money went. But if you look at how much money was coming in from Russia, particularly the Russian mafia, into New York, it's inconceivable to me that Trump wasn't part of that. If you had casinos, what do you think the casinos were created for? To launder money, right?
What years are we talking about?
Okay, so the rape of Russia started 1991.
Yes. And the collusion between Treasury and the Russian mob, et cetera, what years are we covering here?
1997.
Exactly.
Right.
Which is not.
And what was the investment bank at the heart of that movement? Goldman Sachs.
Yes, but it's a very different thing to plunder Russia, which I agree happened. There's no doubt in my mind. But to say that, say, the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service decided to make Trump give him financial favors
has nothing to do with the intelligence service. You have a huge amount of money flowing out of Russia,
yes,
you know, through the U.S. intelligence agencies, the U.S. financial institutions, and the Russian mafia into New York and looking for a place to go.
I completely agree with that scenario.
Right.
Yes. But what the Trump enemies are suggesting is something very different. They're saying that the Russians did favors to Trump in order to then have him owe them favors, and they're going to use it. I don't believe that's that money did not come.
No,
with
but
I
think if we were to get Trump's financial statements and tax statements, we could find a whole bunch of Russian money that came in during that period. You know, that was somehow involved in his financial interests because he's a big New York real estate developer with casinos.
Yeah, but I wouldn't call it Russian money. I would call it money from Russia. But it's not something that could then be used once Trump is president. You see what I'm saying? It's not a quid pro quo that, you know, we'll help you get to the top, you'll be our candidates, and then you'll work for us.
No, but if you look at the flows of money from Russia in around Goldman Sachs and the New York State real estate and casino market at that time,
mm-hmm.
you know, there it would not surprise me to see hundreds of connections.
Yes, but coming from what I would call the fifth column inside Russia, not the people in power since Putin came to power.
I don't know. You know, I don't know. It depends on which oligarch stayed and which ones went. I'm sure
they pretty much all left politics for sure. The deal was some of them were jailed, others, you know, left abroad like Berezovsky. Others still survive today but are out of politics, but their entire operation to plunder Russia has pretty much been shut down.
Well, but remember, the whole group, you know, in the intelligence agencies in the U.S. government who thought they had brought Russia to heel and inside the tent, you know, mm-hmm. I don't think they ever expected it to get rebuilt back and asserting sovereign rights the way it has.
Agreed.
So I think they're very disappointed.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. And they're frightened because they realize that their level of popularity now in Russia is somewhere under 5% tops.
I don't know. Well, let's go to North Korea, because one of the theories given for the show of force in Syria was the, you know, the president was having the summit with Xi Jinping and Tillerson down in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory was this would be a show of force to Xi Jinping. And the idea was he would go back and basically tell North Korea to cool it.
Yeah, that's the theory. Now, do you
believe
that could work?
To North, you know something? I think that North Korea has to do whatever China tells them to do. I think the question is, you know, are they willing to do that in exchange for whatever the U.S. offers them on trade deals or not? I don't know.
But again, look, Trump promised that he would start he would bring China to heel. He would, you know, restore justice and, you know, kick their butts, etc. Now he's going to ask for their help. Secondly, I am not personally a DPRK specialist, but I've listened to quite a few over the past 2 weeks. They're saying that, yes, China plays a major role in North Korea, but cannot force North Korea to do just anything. North Korea has its own, you know, ruling elite and that has its own interests. So I don't think China can really force North Korea to do what? To stop the nuclear program? That almost was stopped when the U.S. negotiated that deal with North Korea. Even Albright Madeleine was involved in these negotiations, and they just decided to not deliver on that. The United States broke that process of negotiation. And if anything, think from a point of view of North Korea. You see Syria that doesn't have nukes that gets bombed for no reason, and then the very same person comes to your neighborhood and said, by the way, we want you to get rid of your nukes. That's ridiculous. And to be honest,
well, I think they developed the nukes because they saw what happened to the Middle East after 9/11.
See, I don't even think they have nuclear weapons as of now. They have a nuclear device, which is very different. But you can't just take any nuclear device, make it into a warhead, mount it to a missile, and then, you know, make that a reliable means of delivery. I think they're working on that, yes. But the real threat is their artillery that can hit Seoul and their special operation forces that can spread, you know, in the enemy rear and create chaos. And these are two threats which aircraft carriers, strike groups, can't deal with. That's another thing. You have to realize that the threat that Trump is shaking right now in front of the nose of the Koreans is not a credible one. The terrain in Korea is not the Middle East. It's hills. It's wooden. You can very, very well hide artillery. You can disperse it. There are no good targets. Even if you hit the command and control in bunkers and tunnels, there'll be plenty left to shoot. So that's not a credible threat. They can shoot down a pretty useless North Korean Air Force, yeah. They can sink most of the useless North Korean Navy, yeah. But what will it do for South Korea? Nothing. So even the threat right now is not a real one. It's again, a show. It's a show that's, you know, I don't know if Trump even believes that it's effective. I don't.
So you think he's doing it just for show?
I don't know. I don't know what they're telling him. I don't know how much he understands. All I'm saying is that, you know, aircraft carrier strike groups are not the kind of force that you need if you want to intimidate a country with the terrain, leadership, and armed forces that North Korea has. That to me is clear. What he's trying to achieve, I don't know. I would never have predicted the airstrike on the airbase in Syria, because to me it's sheer folly and it's self-defeating. I cannot predict somebody who can do something so self-defeating and so crazy. I can't. All I can say is that if the plan is to get rid of ISIS, that's not going to work. And if the plan is to somehow put pressure on the Chinese, which you've just insulted for months nonstop, to put pressure on the North Koreans to do something which they are not even coerced by using aircraft carriers, that's not going to work either. I can say that. But what he will, you know, if tomorrow morning he decides to lob one big bomb in the middle of downtown Pyongyang, you know, would I put it past him? Now I wouldn't put anything past this gang.
Okay,
but doesn't make rational sense? None.
So the Tomahawk missiles were 100 million. The bomb we dropped supposedly on the cave with ISIS was 300 million. I don't know how much money we spent building those caves, but, you know, let's say it's another 20 million. I don't know what it costs to send everybody up near North Korea, but let's figure that's another 20 million.
A lot.
So let's say we're up to 450 million approximately, just for these three moves. Now, if we're about to come into the debt limit, we're going to hit the debt limit on April 28th, so that process is going to start and could, you know, it could take a while to turn into a major brouhaha. But we know the president came out with a blueprint on the budget, and he's got the budget coming out in May. 450 million is a great deal of money. And if you look at what the cuts are going to be, people in America are going to start connecting the dots between, oh, there's 11.5 trillion missing from the Department of Defense and HUD, you know, but you're cutting me this tiny amount of money. Yep. How does that compute?
You know, on my blog, I mentioned a song by Lynyrd Skynyrd where they complain about too much money spent abroad and on the moon. That was written in 1978.
Right.
1978, and we're still at it. So I don't see any, I'm not optimistic for change. I think they will, but what can the American people do about it? Nothing. They don't, they can't go demo, you know, the state is militarized. And, you know, has enough of just ability to use violence to crack down on dissent. I don't think they care about the debts or any the economy or taking away money from poor Americans. They don't. That's why there's more money spent by the U.S. on wars of aggression than the rest of the planet combined.
Right. Well, if you
change
look,
is coming, they'll just print more dollars, rob more countries, and that's about it.
Well, but if you let's go back to the election. It looked to me like you had a real competition, and you and I talked about this, about the people who wanted to keep the unipolar empire going and the people who said, no, we've got to reorganize back into North America. The military is spread too thin. So I think you had a whole part of the military who knows it's really not good to lose wars. And
yep,
you can't afford your... You're spread too thin. You've got to rebuild the Navy. There's all sorts of stuff you've got to do. We need to pull back and take care of number one first.
Mm-hmm.
And what Trump has said in the first 70 days, 80 days of his administration, we're going to do both.
Mm-hmm.
But that can't last through the budget. In other words, in the budget, you got to do one or the other. Can't do both.
Why not?
Well, if you try and do both, and you can always, you know, that's called kick the can. So you can kick the can for another year. What it says is you're going to wipe out the United States, and now you're just fighting. Everything's going to go to the military, and the question is, how is it going to go to the military? What's it going to go for? Is it going to go to keep you spread thin, or is it going to go to rebuild the Navy?
By what mechanism would that destroy the United States?
Well, it would wipe out the middle class because you're going to debase the middle class out of existence.
I think that's already happened.
It's certainly, you certainly made great progress, but it's nothing compared to what would happen next.
Yeah, and the middle class took it. I mean, a lot of people have two jobs now and all on minimal wage, and people with college degrees who work on minimal slave wage. I mean, it's already happening, and nothing, there were no consequences again. So, you know, if there's no, all these discussions about the debt and, you know, and the deficit, I see no change because nothing has happened. We're getting worse and worse. I agree, eventually, somewhere down the line, there will come a point where it's unsustainable. But I think it could be pretty far down the road still.
Right, right.
That's my concern.
Well, what you're literally seeing is, it's funny, I wrote an article at the end after the election called The Productivity Backlash. Mm-hmm. And I ended with a quote from Lawrence Wilkerson, which was basically, you've got the whole economy and the stock market deeply dependent on this military-industrial complex. And
absolutely.
The question is, if you're going to turn it around, you know, you got to turn it around in a way that's better for the stock market than what's going on right now. And I used to see this in Washington, Saker. What I would see is that I would constantly get lobbied to rig the market for what people know how to do. In other words, mm-hmm. if they knew how to, you know, originate mortgages, but they could make more money teaching school, mm-hmm. they would instead come to Washington and get us to rig the market for more mortgages. They didn't want to change. They didn't, you know, they wanted a guaranteed income for what they knew how to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got a war machine, and that's what it knows how to do. And
I think that war machine is indispensable now because it's the only thing that's backing the U.S. dollar.
Right.
So it's and somewhere it becomes vital to keep that war machine going, because you can still print dollars and you can still go to Europe and buy every asset you want for dollars. They'll take it. You can still buy energy. You can still corrupt leaders. You can still, the dollar, the fact is, the dollar is used out there. It still is. And the U.S. can print as much, as many of them as it pretty much wants. And if there's any, you know, bad attitude towards that, then we send in the carriers. I think that's the idea. Now, the problem with that is that carriers are not good as a weapon against a powerful state. They're excellent. They're fantastic for second and third rate countries. But when you're dealing with countries who actually can fight back, they're not very useful.
Right.
So that's where the problem is. I mean, I agree with you. It's starting to crack, but how long will it take until the real, you know, big crack happens?
Well, I think that's why the rush to get everybody inside the dollar system, because that's what this is. You have two things going on. You're trying to get all the countries who are outside the system in, number one, or destroyed, and you're declaring a war on cash, because that's what you want. You want everybody chipped and digital cash, and then everybody's in the system, and you can harvest globally.
Yep.
And you don't have to just depend on force. You can depend on digital force.
And on fantastic intelligence. If you have digital knowledge of what an entire country spends, like, imagine what the U.S. credit cards know, everything that's spent in Russia that's using MasterCard or Visa, or et cetera. I mean, or same thing for China. Well, that is a fantastic source of first-rate intelligence. So, yeah, that's where the real power is. I agree with you.
Right. So I think part of this hysteria is, you know, they were planning, again, seven countries plus North Korea in 5 years after 2001, and that would have been 2006. You know, needless to say, they didn't make it. It's 11 years later. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the plans to use food, I think they were trying to replace the oil standard on the dollar with the food standard, and that's what the GMO was all about. But the Doha round fell down. Europe was too difficult about GMOs. That didn't work. And so now the rush is on to get digital cash and to make sure everybody's chipped. So, and the question is, can they make it? I don't think they can make it.
I don't think so either. You know, I think China and Russia are going to not, they're creating their own. China already has it. Russia just is catching up now with their own credit card system. And this entire group that gravitates around Russia and China is gradually pulling out from the dollar zone.
Well, you know, I went into the airport in Sydney to buy, I was buying a watch, and I walked up and there were three, she said, put your card in, and there are three different machines. And I said, I pointed to, you know, one was sort of MasterCard Visa, and I said, well, what's the other? And she said, oh, that's for the Chinese cards. They have their own cards.
Yep. Yeah. And I think we're seeing it in the United States already coming also. I'm not sure about that, but I think I heard that there are places that accept the Chinese card here.
Really?
Yeah, that's what maybe I'm wrong, but that's what I think I read somewhere.
That's why I think the digital, you know, the Economist, speaking of the Rothschilds, the Economist just had an article, and it shows a laptop with a hand reaching through, and it says, why your computer will never be safe. And if you look, I mean, basically warfare is moving onto that platform as well.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah, so we are contemplating a world where everything is run through digital systems, none of which are safe.
Yeah, but in a multipolar world, you could have an arrangement where you can choose where you're unsafe with. That is, I agree, digital systems are inherently unsafe. But if you're running on a Chinese or a Russian network, you don't have to fear Uncle Sam as much. And vice versa. If you're running on an American network, you're safer from the Russian than the Chinese. So I still think the multipolar world is going to happen. I just think it's going to happen through much more dramatic, possibly, events than what I'd hoped for, because I saw a real, my hope, my biggest hope with Trump was that he would gently land the United States, you know, and more or less gently begin the process of converting the United States from an empire into a what I call a regular country, even if it's a very big one.
Well, it's interesting. If you look at his knowledge, if you look at his knowledge and skills, he has a combination of knowledge and skills that is uniquely appropriate for figuring out how to get from here to there. And I too was hopeful, and I'm still not quite sure why he's done this amazing U-turn. I mean, this is a complete 180 in a few weeks with no explanation. Yeah.
Well, the way he betrayed Flynn and Bannon tells me that he has no moral fiber. He's also a bad, I think he's actually a bad manager, because if you dump people who are your closest allies, that way nobody will take a risk for you.
Right.
So what he did is just so self-defeating that I can only imagine that either he's weak or he's, you know, doesn't have a moral backbone. But I'm shocked at how disappointed I am with him. My hopes were not that high, but at least I had some. Now it's dark.
Well, I still think we're infinitely better off than if we had Clinton.
Oh yeah, absolutely. No, there's absolutely not in my mind. But we're getting there. That's what disappoints me. We're right back to the same kind of topic, and I don't like that conversation. Will there be a war? It's just not a topic I like. I want to get rid of that topic. You know.
Well, here's what I see. You know, we're coming into the budget. Again, the debt limit. We hit the debt limit on April 28th, and so we're going to have the debt squabbles going on between now, and it could last as long as October. And then you have the president coming out with the budget in May. And this is a guy who seems to kind of, his policy is the last person he talked to. But when you get down to the budget, that's where you have to integrate everything. You know, and it can't be, you know, you can't change it every day. You've got to pick a number and allocate the numbers. And that's where you really lock in the policy. So I'm waiting to May until I see what comes out. But you have all of America who's going to start. I think you've got a lot more people are going to start being interested in, okay, you know, if we could afford $450 million to have this dance, you know, with the bombs, we could, you know, that's enough money to reclaim the Great Lakes. So there's going to be some very hard discussions.
If it ever comes to a serious risk for the power of the people who are Trump's puppeteers now, maybe Mr. Kushner, I don't know. If it ever comes to that there will be a serious crisis inside the United States, you know, there's another use you can have for an aircraft carrier. And that's a fantastic target that you can fairly easily lose. If you provoke sufficiently the North Koreans or maybe the Chinese, somebody can hit an aircraft carrier. They're not that invulnerable at all. And if that happens, you know, it's going to be 9/11 repeated in terms of the same hysteria, and everything else will be forgotten. Like 9/11 totally obliterated the trillions of dollars missing from the Pentagon.
Right.
See, they have that option. Simply do something, I mean, completely stupid, and do it deliberately, like Pearl Harbor, with the hope that somebody's going to hit a carrier. And then, you know, all bets are off, and we can go back to what we love most, which is a, you know, big, big war.
Well, I have two concerns, and that is, if you look at the budget, there are two things happening in the budget. One, you have the entire population. If you take any topic like healthcare, you have the entire general population in a state of deep denial about what it's going to take to reach an economic solution.
Yes, agreed.
So, you know, the insurance companies, the pharmaceuticals, the, you know, the general it's everybody. It's not, you can't point your finger at just one group. But everybody's in a state of deep denial. So yes. That's number one. But the second thing is, if you look at how much money is being pulled out of the budget in secret, you know, you are financing two civilizations out of the budget of one and keeping one of those civilizations secret.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely.
Right. And I think the push to war, part of it is because you can't afford transparency, and war is what will keep you from transparency.
Yeah, and war is a wonderful way of protecting corruption. For instance, you've probably heard of that huge weapons depot that blew up in the Ukraine. And the specialists predicted that it would take weeks to extinguish it. It took, I think, 24 hours. And the reason why is that a lot of that stuff was missing. But now that's burned, you can't prove it. It's all been stolen, and now that's burned, you know, and there's something. That's it. It all disappeared. Wars have exactly the same effect. You can make a killing on corruption during war. It's fantastically profitable.
Right. Well, so anything we should be cheerful about? Tell us what you think is happening inside of Russia right now.
I think that's what we should be cheerful about, is that the Russians are extremely cautious. They're not taking the bait, and I think it's a good thing, even if it's a frustrating thing. I mean, there comes a point where I would wish, you know, that they would just make a loud, big statement or do something. But considering that there, every step you take, there's millions of lives at stake, I have to say that that policy of caution is a good one. Bid for time, be extremely cautious, and gradually, you know, try to win in the long term. I think it's much preferable to a policy which would have, you know, big spectacular actions to look good and feel good, but that are counterproductive in the long run.
When I was in Toronto in March, I saw Daniel Estulin, who, are you familiar with his work?
No.
He's from a Russian family. They live in Canada. He wrote a book on the Bilderbergers, but he claims to be in coordination with the Russian intelligence. So he goes back to Russia on occasion. Anyway, what he said is he thinks the population is deeply unhappy, not necessarily because of the political leadership, but because of just hard circumstances in the economy as a result of the sanctions and the drop in the oil price. So he just kind of feels like it's hard times.
I would disagree with it. I think there are a lot of people who are unhappy. Indeed, that's true. But I think the culprit, and I think that people know that the cause are not as much the sanctions or the fall in oil prices as it is the corruption and incompetence of the Medvedev government and the internal policies, the economics of the Russian government. I think that's where the real problem is. And yet people aren't happy about that. The good news is that they're being roundly criticized on mainstream TV and the media all over. I mean, the economic bloc, the people who take the economic decisions in the Medvedev government are extremely unpopular, and that's good. And in spite of that unpopularity, there were demonstrations organized recently all over Russia. But if you look at the actual numbers involved, it's not that big considering that people are going through tough times. So when I correspond with people who discuss that issue with me, I say, remember, the country is at war. It is a war. It's an informational war, an economic war, and only to some extent a military one. And for a country at war, I would argue Russia is doing pretty well, actually.
Oh, I would say it's doing remarkably because, you know, if you inflicted the same drop in commodity prices and the same sanctions on the United States, I can't imagine what would be going on here now.
Yeah, but remember, the Russians could look across the border and look at what's happening in the Ukraine.
Right.
They feel cornered. They feel that there's no other option. I agree with them. I think there's no other option than to resist, and Putin is the only game in town. So I think even if such circumstances get objectively even worse, and there's some reason to believe they're going to get better again now, I still think that the correct position is to accept the fact that you're at war and know it's going to be hard at war. But it's still preferable to an actual overt war, you know, with hundreds of thousands or millions of people dying.
It's better than Stalingrad.
Yes, and keep in mind, this is a topic that's discussed every week on TV. Will there be a war? What kind of war? What's going to happen? It's constantly discussed. So the people are very much aware of why they're suffering.
Right. Right. It's quite remarkable. Now, what do you think of Tillerson's trip to Moscow? Did you think it did any good whatsoever?
Yes, I think it did. First of all, he did not bring in an ultimatum, which was the big fear that I had, and a lot of people saying in Russia, if that's what he's coming with, you know, this is not going to end well. The fact that he spoke with, I think, for Lavrov with 5 hours, and after that he was received by Putin for another two, these are not the kind of people and the number of hours where you sit there and just lecture them about having to submit to Uncle Sam. These were substantive conversations. I don't think, I cannot guess what was, I mean, I can't guess, but I have no knowledge of what was discussed. But it was most definitely substantive, and that by itself just pushes further away the risk of a nuclear war between the two countries. So I am really relieved by that. I wasn't expecting, even the meeting with Putin, I thought it wouldn't happen, because the Russians were pretty mad at the first when that all this, Syrian thing happened. But it did. So I think he did something useful there. I think he was in a horrible position. I don't envy him, because I'm sure they'd shoot him out behind closed doors. And I think he's an intelligent man. So he probably had to sit there and get, verbally beat up and not have much to reply. But I think something important must have happened there. And that gives me hope.
See, I think Tillerson is the most gifted guy in the cabinet. I have.
He said that amazing sentence after he came out. He said, our relationship, I don't remember exactly what it said, but our relationship is extremely bad, and that's not something that's acceptable between two nuclear superpowers. That tells me that he understands exactly what's at stake. It doesn't have to be a love fest, but anything that makes the other one unpredictable or threatens the other one is absolutely unacceptable, and I think he understands that.
Well, the other thing is they agreed to do a working group where they could work on improving things where we had agreement and could get things done.
We'll see if that happens, like the famous investigation in Syria. They agreed to do it, but that might be just, body language to make things look, to show some achievements. I'm not sure that this will actually happen, but I hope it does.
One of the things that shocked me, and I still don't understand, is you saw Tillerson make an announcement after the bombing in Syria, where he clearly believed that the Syrians were guilty. I think he was sincere. And it shocked me. Who could possibly trick Tillerson? Now, he's new to government, so I don't think he may necessarily know how, the extraordinary talent that can be put to work tricking you. I've experienced it, and I know how powerful it is. But, this is a guy who's very, very smart and has a lot of experience and is hard to trick. So he clearly believed it.
I can't believe that he did really believe that. I mean, if he did, I'm not sure it's good news, because then he doesn't have what it takes to be a Secretary of State. Because the notion that it was actually what the U.S. says it was is ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Well, there's another possibility in that he was aware of something that was a lot more frightening.
Look, the Syrians had an overwhelming rationale to be on their absolutely best behavior.
Right, of course.
No logic for them, and they didn't have those nuclear weapons, and it wasn't sarin gas. So, I can't believe Tillerson would believe that. I can't. I think he's just a good liar. I hope that's what he is. Really, I hope he's a skilled
guy. Yeah. I don't know. I'm watching the situation, and I still don't have an hypothesis that explains everything. So I'm just going to keep. I feel like one of those hound dogs who's wandering around the bush whining because I know there's a duck there. I just can't find it
somewhere.
Well,
look just at all the articles that were written by truly independent analysts. I don't think anybody in the blogosphere bought the possibility that the Syrians actually did it. I didn't come across a single person who said, yeah.
Well, here's my only theory. I think there is a less than 1% of 1% of 1% chance that Assad ordered such a thing. Now, could the Israelis have made a deal with one of Assad's commanders who pulled a funny on him? Is that possible?
I don't think so, because I don't think they had the infrastructure to even.
They didn't have the infrastructure to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. As far as the U.S. and Russia both said that chemical weapons were removed. Plus, I'm not even sure it was a chemical weapon. I'm not even sure that there was a chemical weapon. There was some toxic gas involved, but toxic gas does not mean chemical weapon. I'm not sure there are weapons involved here, at least not chemical ones.
Well, it's just like all the other situations we run into these days. The whole story makes no sense.
Agreed. It makes no sense whatsoever. And I think Assad has a record of being actually a rational man.
I don't. Okay, one more question before we go. And, you know, okay. Saker, it's always so fascinating. So I've got to pump you because I don't get you for another quarter. Pompeo came out, you know, screaming about WikiLeaks and how we had to do something about WikiLeaks. What is he afraid is coming out?
I don't know what he's afraid is coming out, but I think he is, you know, he's feeling guilty because he knows there's a lot of things that could come out, and I don't think he can conceive that it's coming from anywhere else except for the Russian military intelligence, which I have no reason, again, that's a theory that's out there. I have no reason to believe it. I think he's just trying to basically criminalize and denounce all the bad people, traitors, etc., like Assange and Snowden and WikiLeaks and all this. You know, he calls them Russian-controlled. If it was China, it would be Chinese-controlled. I mean, I think it's just empty rhetoric of a guy who's not quite sure that he can keep things secret as he used to keep them in the past. Again,
well, here's the interesting thing. You know, the reason we invented the war on terrorism is because the beauty of the war on terrorism, you could keep it going forever because there was no enemy. You know, there's no enemy to kill. You couldn't kill the enemy, so you could keep it going forever. But I think it must have run out because we need the Russians. Terrorism isn't working.
Agreed. I think the Russians are a much better threat. And you can blame everything on them. If tomorrow there's a snowstorm, you can say that this is the climatological weapons of the Kremlin. And if tomorrow there's a riot in, you know, in St. Louis, you can say that the rioters were all paid agents and Vladimir Putin personally gave the order to start the rioting. Like the Brits said that the Russian hooligans are personally commanded by Putin. You know, I mean, it's perfect. As long as people are willing to buy that kind of nonsense, I don't see why the propaganda machine should stop churning out that kind of nonsense. It seems to be, we see the opposition comes from the blogosphere and the internet.
Right.
But the main street is still taking it and buying into it. I don't know to what degree people believe it, but it's good enough. If people are quiet, that's good enough.
Well, it's funny. In the old days, I used to think that they were concerned that they couldn't keep the financial system patched together. But as I'm watching this, I'm becoming more and more convinced that the leadership is really worried about sort of infighting among the leadership. The corruption is so great, and the criminal liabilities are so great, and the unravelings that we've seen happen either around the pedophilia, around the Clinton Foundation, are so shocking to the population. The population is deeply angry in a way I've never seen before. So I do think there's something happening. And I think they're ready to really fight. Now, whether that translates into something that is meaningful, you know, remains to be seen. But I think the leadership is really afraid of the extent to which some of those scandals could, you know, could end up with the establishment being so, you know, the fighting among the establishment being so ugly that they couldn't keep it together.
It could happen. I mean, I'm sure, I agree with you that the population is angry and frustrated and just that there's a lot of rage that's contained because people are afraid. But it's definitely there, yeah. The country is extremely unstable.
Right.
But for the time being, it can appear to look stable for quite a while longer. As long as, I think, for instance, the betrayal of Trump is going to have a tremendous psychological effect on those, all the people who truly believed in him. They're going to feel really despondent and even more hopeless. Now, it's hard to vote for Obama hoping for real change you can believe in and then get the opposite and then hope to vote for Trump and again get 180. I mean, every time Americans vote for X and get Y, every time. It's very depressing.
Well, to what extent can the leadership take care of that by impeaching Trump?
I think they'll do it just because that's the kind of hateful people they are. Yeah, they can, absolutely. And then they can say that somebody new has come to power and then continue the same policy. Even, I'll tell you, those pedophile stuff at Pizzagate, if it comes to that, they can sacrifice a good chunk of the top people and still, the deep state will remain still hidden. I mean, what this country needs is not government change, it's regime change. It really needs regime change in a very profound meaning of the word. not just a different garment, a different president.
Well, but I think it needs more than that, because I think it needs a consciousness shift. I think you need the American people to have a very significant consciousness shift, because the power in this country starts 3,100 counties, one county at a time. And, you know, the problem is not just in Washington, it's in every county. The drug dealing, the mortgage fraud, it's every county.
But and look, haven't they proven
clean
that?
It up, what?
Haven't they proven that they have their conscience changed by voting for Trump in spite of the hate campaign?
No, because
no?
If you vote for Trump, I'll tell you why. If you vote for Trump, you're thinking that the prisoner at the top can do something. So let me go back to my red button story. When I was giving a speech in 2000, and I was explaining that the U.S. economy launders $500 billion to $1 trillion of dirty money as of 1998. It's much more now. And we're the global leader in money laundering for illegal money. Mm-hmm. So I said to a group, I was speaking in a conference of spiritually evolved people, it's called Spiritual Frontiers Foundation. The goal of the conference is to talk about how to evolve our society spiritually. So I said, okay, if you could stop, if you could, by pushing, just pretend there's a red button up here on the lectern. If you could stop all hard narcotics trafficking in your city or county tomorrow, by pushing this red button, thus offending the people who control $500 billion to $1 trillion a year, would you push the button? And out of 100 people dedicated to evolving our society spiritually, only one would push the button. So I said to the other 99, why would you not push the button? And they said, well, we don't want our government checks to stop, you know, because we need that money to finance the government. We don't want our taxes to go up, and we don't want our 401ks to go down, because all that money would go to Zurich and London and Hong Kong, you know, and leave the New York Stock Exchange, so our pension funds would go down. Hmm. So that's the problem. If you became president tomorrow, your political guy would say, well, the American people just spent $2 billion to get you elected, and they all want their check. You know, they want their Social Security check, they want their government contract, they want their community block development grant. And you'd turn to Steve Mnuchin, your Secretary of the Treasury, and you'd say, well, you better be nice to the people who control $500 billion to $1 trillion of all dirty money and the accumulated capital they're on. So you are economically dependent on the machinery, and the machinery is economically dependent on harvesting other people with war and organized crime. And there's nothing you can do. If you're the president, you cannot push the red button if you're, you know, 99% of the most spiritually evolved people in the country will not push the red button. Now, you can campaign and say you're going to, but the reality is they want their check, and they want you to tell them that they're good Christians and make them feel good so that they don't have to face up to the challenge. And the reason, you know, if you go back in American politics, you know, Goldwater said, you know, at the end of World War II, we got 5% of the people and 50% of the resources. To keep that going, we're going to have to drop a few bombs. And the American people said, oh, no, we're good Christians, we don't want to do that. So Jimmy Carter got up in front of the fireplace, and he, you know, and he kind of shivered in front of the fireplace, and he said, okay, we're, you know, we're going to have to cut back. And the American people said, no, we don't want we don't want to cut back. And then the Bushes came along and said, you know something, you're all the good Christians, here's your check, don't ask questions. And everybody said, well, that's a plan. So the reality is, if you want to turn this around, you've got to do it one county at a time. And that's why I'm such a big believer in place-based financial disclosure of the U.S. budget, because you can figure out and make all those trade-offs and kill a lot of the waste just by reoptimizing bottom-up. But that means no central control, and that ultimately means transparency about the black budget.
But even if there was a constituency for that, how long would it take to make that happen?
I think you could make unbelievable and remarkable progress in 5 to 10 years. Unbelievable, because the waste is so enormous, and the oppression, you know, the negative return on investment to taxpayers from the centralization is just mind-boggling. So especially with new technology, the possibilities for new productivity and wealth are incredible. So I'm just saying, theoretically, you can turn the red button green. You can make money pushing the red button, but you've got to have a radical shift in consciousness. It's why I keep getting people, trying to get people interested in their local elections. I keep saying, You know, why vote for the prisoner at the top when you can have real power shifting what's happening locally? Because it's going to, you got to do it 3,100 counties at a time.
Just what I think of your time frame of 5 to 10 years, I'm not even sure the empire has that much left.
They might not.
I think there's going to be a crisis, an outside crisis, which is going to trigger a collapse, a brutal collapse. And then at that point, I just read recently a book by John Michael Greer called Twilight's Last Gleaming, which I highly recommend to you if you haven't read it. He describes it's a great book. He describes how a bad use of an aircraft carrier ends up in the dissolution of the United States. And he gives, one possible scenario, and I think that's kind of where we're headed. I think we're headed for an external catastrophe which will have an internal consequence so severe that basically the country could break up.
Well, that may be one of their goals. So there's been a lot of indication. I think that's why they were trying to get a constitutional convention so they could break up the country. But
he discusses reality... that actually in the book also, constitutional convention.
Right.
I think you'll like the book a lot.
I will definitely get it. The one thing I would say is I really believed if the Trump administration could come in and rebuild the military, because it is spread too thin and it's dangerous if you're going to try and maintain reserve currency status. I believe that if they would do that, that you could, you could prevent the kind of scenario happening that you're describing. And it may be possible that instead of doing that, you've just got a group of people who are so greedy, they just want to finish soaking it for what they can before it collapses.
Yeah, that's more where I am, I think, in my feelings about it, where we're headed.
Oy! Okay. Well, my attempts at getting one optimistic statement out, you have failed completely.
No, I mean, obviously, Tillerson traveled to Moscow and we're a step removed, at least I hope. It was better after than before his trips. It's the only good thing I can mention. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, Saker, it's always a delight. We look forward to talking to you after the second quarter is over, and I'm sure it'll be... We have a very interesting year ahead of us, so
yes,
more to come.
So let's hope there'll be good news then.
Just remind everybody where they can find you on the web.
My website is called the Saker, or Vineyard of the Saker. The address of is the Saker in one word. .is. It's based in Iceland. So, the Saker.is is where you get my article and lots of very, very good guest posts and comments, etc. You can find me there.
Now, mention your book as well because it's remarkable. Just remember before you print it out, it's very long.
Yeah, it's called The Essential Saker. You can there's a link towards Amazon on my website there, and you can get it off Amazon. And it's a collection of essays and all sorts of different topics discussed in it.
It's very remarkable because I was in Belgium and the Netherlands for a couple weeks recently. I just got back. And when you talk with everybody about the French elections, it's a much more organic, yeasty process than you get... You just don't get a good sense of what's going on in the politics in France and Europe. And there's sections in your book which really convey it that are marvelous. So if you want to get a better feel for what's really going on in Europe, it's really tremendous. Anyway,
yes, I have one of my guests who regularly writes for me is a journalist called Ramin Mazahiri, who is based in France. And he's a top specialist of the internal politics of the French elections. I highly recommend his articles. They're in the guest post section, and they're wonderful.
Well, that's one of the things I'm going to want to talk about next is the French elections. We've got the first round coming up very shortly, but then we'll know a lot more by the next time. So,
yep, let's do that.
Very interesting times. Okay, Saker, have a wonderful afternoon, and thank you again.
Same to you, and it was a pleasure as always. Have a wonderful day. Bye-bye.